Welcome to The X-Files, Stories of Life After God. This special feature of the Life After God podcast explores stories of diverse people who have left the faith and religion they grew up with. In each episode, individuals will share in their own words how and why their worldview changed, the gains and losses associated with their religious and spiritual transition, the lessons they've learned in the process, and what their life is like now. To learn more about The X-Files and the Life After God podcast, please visit our website at lifeaftergod.org. Special thanks to Ian Gordon for the use of the theme music, The Truth Is Out There. If you would like to consider sharing your story in a future episode of The X-Files, please send a short email to ryan at lifeaftergod.org. Today on The X-Files, I speak with Pat Green. Pat is a former Christian pastor and recovering evangelical. Pat's claim to fame is that he is the father of Dave. He has been a successful business person, a taxicab driver, and is currently a writer and photographer living in Chicago. Pat was originally on the Life After God podcast back in 2015 when I first started the show, and I'm honored to have him back. This episode comes with a content notification. In the conversation that follows, we discuss Pat's recent suicide attempt, how he survived, what he has learned about himself, and what he wants from his life going forward. I want to express my deep gratitude to Pat for courageously sharing his story and courageously choosing life. Pat writes a column for the Patheos website entitled Transparent Expedition, where he writes in his characteristic raw, honest way about being the father of a gender-fluid child and his experience of being a recovering evangelical. Please follow his writing by going to the link in the show notes. Hey, Pat, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ryan. It's great to be back.
Yes, it's been a while since you've been on the show. In fact, you were in the first season or the first episodes, I think even maybe the first two or three.
I think I was number three.
Yeah. That was, I think it was Greta and then David Hayward and then you, if I remember correctly.
That sounds about right.
But a lot has transpired since those 4 years ago, and we've been chatting off and on through the years on Facebook. Still haven't had the pleasure of meeting you in person, wanted to catch up because you've had some, you know, interesting events transpire related to the main topic of this podcast, our journeys, our lives after a departure from whatever version of God we've had in our lives in the past, and then just kind of how we struggle to shape our lives as humans, as humanists, as people who believe that this is the one life we have and we need to make the best of it. So for those that haven't heard the whole catalog, and I guess there are probably a few of you that haven't heard the whole catalog of Life After God, just tell us a little bit about who you are, your background. I know you and I are both former clergy. Tell us a little bit about what your life was like 10 years ago.
10 years ago, that would have been 2009. I was a minister of a church that I was the senior pastor at. It was called LifeBridge. When I started off LifeBridge, I was with the Churches of God General Conference, which was just your general evangelical church. And I was just starting into the emergent movement, which was a very progressive movement. I would liken it to evangelicals loosening their ties and trying to understand the world of the mainline progressive Christian movement. And shortly after that, I want to say 2012, I started having a deconstruction of faith.
Okay.
Because they told us to deconstruct everything and tear it all down. And I crossed the line and tore it down to a point of disbelief. And that was further enforced after I left ministry and drove a taxi for a couple of years.
So the emergent movement, again, just to sort of backtrack on that just for a second, the emergent movement was a group of initially youth pastors, right?
Right.
And then it became some senior pastors and then some parachurch leaders and authors and various things. And you know, I think you summarize it so perfectly that it really was about deconstructing. And I've a guy named Tomlinson, David Tomlinson, I believe, in the UK, wrote a book called The Post-Evangelical. And I really felt like post-evangelical was a great way to describe the emergent movement. It was evangelicals trying to move beyond the strictures of evangelicalism, meaning, you know, literal reading of the Bible, exclusive relationships, in other words, excluding, you know, being more aware of racism in the church, being more aware of chauvinism in the church, trying to analyze and deconstruct some of those things. But as you say, that deconstruction, you know, was, I think, intended to stop at some point, right? We were supposed to hold on to the basic tenets of Christianity, just not evangelicalism.
Exactly, exactly. Now, you could turn that into a little bit of universalism. That was accepted.
Oh, right.
But atheism crossed the line.
Yeah, yeah. So for those maybe not familiar, universalism, tell us what, in a sentence or two, what is that?
All roads lead to God.
And that everyone's going to be okay, basically, mm-hmm. right? Like, God's not going to punish anyone.
Right.
Because I think there's a big problem ethically in Christianity with the punishment aspect of Christianity. And so
it's not only the punishment, but it's the reduction of self. Anytime you do something good, all the glory goes to God. And anytime you speak of yourself, you are a sinner who is less. And the only way you get anything is because God's loved you so much that he killed his kid.
Right. Right. So you're basically worthless the whole time. In fact, I just had a conversation with my friend Tim Hellman, that is the previous episode, where he talks about this being the breaking point for him when he had children and he was faced with the task of explaining the gospel to them. And basically what that meant was he had to tell them in childish terms that they were no good.
Yeah. Yeah.
That their only hope was through Jesus, and that by themselves they were, you know, horrible, fit for eternal punishment.
It's a tough thing to teach in a nice way, but we have this strange cognitive disconnect. The first thing that I can think of whenever you speak to that is the story of Noah's Ark. We have turned mass genocide into a cute kid story with animals in a boat.
Yeah, we'll decorate entire babies' rooms with the theme.
Right.
Yeah, it's wild. So, I mean, I think, you know, and I think theology, one of the ways I sometimes describe theology sort of tongue-in-cheek to my non-Christian friends who don't quite understand is that theology is basically people with a more evolved sense of ethics trying to square the circle of the Bible.
That would be fair.
Right, like trying to make the Bible fit into a modern world in which some of the things the Bible says we kind of, shudder at.
Yeah.
So as you deconstruct beyond the safe limits of the emergent movement, what happened after that?
There was a lot of alienation, and as my child was coming out as transgender and now gender fluid, there was a lack of understanding, and it was kind of a slap in the face and also a mirror in the face, because I remember when I was part of the Outlaw Preachers during our 2010 reunion, we brought people that were not fully on board with affirming and accepting the LGBTQ movement. And the LGBTQ people in the Outlaw Preachers were like, this is harmful for us. Don't let us into this kind of a situation. And we kept on saying that this is grace and that they have to come to the table to the oppressor. And in actuality, that's harmful codependency. And when I saw that narrative being spoken to about my child, it was very, very difficult. It was very painful. And my child even said to me one day, Dad, you know, it kind of brings to light that whole quote from Martin Luther King. It's not the actions of your enemies, but it's the silence of your friends.
Wow. Yeah. And you had that show up right in the middle of the most important relationship in your life.
Yes, and that was all going on during a year that I was getting divorced, and the church that I had built was falling apart.
Mm. Wow. So when you talk about deconstruction, I mean, it's a philosophical category, but it's also literally what's happening in your life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the analogy that I use for the God portion is Calvin and Hobbes. One day, Calvin is going to grow up and realize that Hobbes is just a stuffed tiger and not his best friend.
Right.
Now make that best friend your Lord and Savior, who you've been communicating to since you were 13, 14 years old. And that's painful. I went into agnostic atheism kicking and screaming.
Yeah, you didn't want to be there, in other words.
Right. I wanted all of this to be true. And it was hard. It was a very painful experience, because normally when I was in times of trials, I would rely on this net whenever I was walking on the tightrope, and now the safety net is gone.
Right. Yeah. You know, that's a great analogy that I hadn't thought of before. But when you have the net, you're walking on the same tightrope. Like, the tightrope hasn't changed. The height of the tightrope above the ground hasn't changed. Your abilities to walk on it haven't changed. The only thing that's changed is this net, which, as it turns out, means quite a bit psychologically, right? I mean, I feel like it's a really different thing to see someone do that with a net and then see someone do it without a net.
Oh, yeah. Well, taking risks was a lot easier when I was a minister. And I took a lot of risks, and we did some good. These days, even today, I find it more difficult to take risks because there is the fear of failure.
Right. Yeah, absolute failure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no do-overs. I mean, Christianity is really, I often talk about Christianity as a promise, you know, like lots of promises that add up to like the promise, which is that you're safe, like you can't really fail. And
right.
When that's gone, life becomes much more like technicolor, like things get a little more intense. And you realize, when you realize this is the only life we have, each day, each moment becomes so much more valuable, so much more precious. And the loss of those moments feels much more painful and can, you know, lead to some real crisis in one's life. As we both know, I mean, your story mirrors mine in so many interesting ways. So I wanted to ask you about your marriage. Was that a result of the sort of theological deconstruction, or was that sort of a parallel track?
I used to say yes to that, but in all honesty, it was, you know, hindsight always being 20/20. It was two grown adults who. We got married young, and
yeah,
our life perspectives changed, and we had a hard time forgiving and understanding, and the chasm just widened to the point where the center couldn't hold.
Yeah, that's exactly my story as well. It wasn't, I mean, I think my ex-wife, you know, would answer some questions differently if asked about her beliefs. She would answer differently than I would. I'm not sure exactly how she would answer, and it's not for me to say, but we were on a similar path of like realizing that the Adventist Church was extremely limited, if not damaging, outright damaging to people. And so it wasn't at all like she was this devoted believer, and because I had this crisis of faith, she was like, I'm out of here, or something like that.
Right.
So it has not been a smooth road for you. is that fair to say?
No, it has not.
Up until today, even. Like, you know, you just told me before we started recording that you start a new job tomorrow, which is sort of the latest chapter in a pretty difficult stretch. And you also recently wrote about how despairing your life had become to the point that you attempted to take your own life. And I wonder if we could kind of walk through some of that, because I know it begins with, well, begins. I mean, where does it begin? But one section of your story begins about a year ago when you had really hit rock bottom.
Yeah, a year ago, I was financially struggling, and I was in a spot where I was facing potential homelessness. And as I went to work every day, I live in the suburbs of Chicago, and I work in the city. And so I would get on the train to take it to the city. And every day, well, not every day, but many days, I would sit on that train platform waiting for my train. And an express train would come by about 5 minutes before mine. And every so often, I would think about jumping. And this intrusive thought was not really from a conscious effort, and it started scaring me. So I started trying to take my mental health seriously, but I wasn't yet in a space where I was ready to be honest about certain childhood traumas. So it was basically a Band-Aid over a bullet wound. And I'm still hemorrhaging inside, but I'm trying to mask the symptoms. But I'm going to see my therapist. I'm going to, I'm taking my meds, so on and so forth. July of this year, I had lost a job, and I couldn't afford Cobra anymore. So I was off the meds and no longer seeing my therapist. I don't want to get into all of the interpersonal details of my life, but then on Veterans Day of this year, there was a suicide attempt. I had a mother that was in home hospice with me that I was caring for. She's still alive, but she's at a hospice center now. I had a relationship, a romantic one that had been going on for 3 years that was nearing the end. And a lot of that had to do with me. And, you know, whenever you get closed off, you are not honest. And, I felt that train coming to the station, if you will. And, so many other pressures. I woke up and I had this moment where I instinctively said, screw it. And I'm not going to name the medicine because I don't want to inspire others, but I took over 10 times the normal dosage of this medicine and followed it with a fireball chaser.
Wow. You wrote about this in your blog recently, which is why I would have the temerity to even ask you these things.
I have no problem discussing it.
Okay, good. Yeah. And of course I knew that already going in, but, you know, these are sensitive subjects. And, of course we, you know, in the intro to this episode, I was sure to share a content notification, you know, because we don't want to, you know, cause harm also by relating these things either to anyone listening or to you, you know. And so I know that you're processing this with others and not just out there on your own. So you obviously are still here, which I'm so grateful for. And I know like hundreds of people that you know in real life and also just people like me you haven't actually met in real life on Facebook and social networks that are just so happy that you're still here. How did you make it through?
Around the time that I had taken the meds, my now ex-partner sent me a text asking me if everything was okay, and I lied and said, yes, I'll talk to you later. And then my child, Dave, sent me a picture that they drew and said, hey, do you like this? And I'm like, yes, I love it. And about half an hour later, and I'm guessing there, I really regretted what I had done here. And I could feel the effects of the medication taking place. So I tried to go to the bathroom to regurgitate the meds. And that was difficult to do. But I got a little bit out, enough to stay alive, I suspect.
Yeah.
And for 12 hours, I was fighting to remain conscious. Mm. My hands were shaky, and I couldn't walk until about 3 that afternoon. Mm. And then around 7 o'clock in the afternoon, 8 o'clock, in, or 7 or 8 in the evening, I've got 8 police at my doorstep. Wow. Because somebody called in a wellness check. And I told them what I'd done. And next thing I know, I'm being whisked away in an ambulance with 2 paramedics trying to make sure that I was stable. And before we started the psych portion of the hospital visit, for 2 days, I was in the hospital proper as they got my my kidney levels, my liver enzymes, my blood sugar, and my white blood cell count was just, everything was off kilter.
Wow.
And so I had to be medically stabilized before they could put me in to the mental health wing for the beginning of the bottom.
Right. Wow. Well, just once again, just so happy that you got that phone call, or that call came in from your loved ones that sent those officers to your door, and that you're here, you know, and healthy, like you're physically stable and doing well. You're home now, I guess. And like looking back on the last few weeks, I mean, what's the takeaway for you? And I know we're also facing a crisis in our culture around depression and loneliness and suicide. I know so many people haven't been to that brink, but many others have. What is your takeaway from your experience?
On a personal level, I'm going to answer this 2 ways. First, sure. On a personal level, then on the broader level. On a personal level, I'm learning what trauma from childhood does to a person. And how, if you don't face that and don't own it and disclose it, you're just kind of building your life on like a drunken game of Jenga. You're taking pieces from the bottom and putting them up top, and everything gets less and less stable, and it will eventually crumble. So I'm learning a lot about PTSD and complex trauma, which is something that I'm dealing with right now. And I'm also learning what I have done to my self-esteem and my depersonalization. And, you know, I'll let you ask questions about that later, but the broader world, I'm learning how deep of a problem this is for so many. You know, according to the CDC, this is the second leading cause of death for teenagers. And for middle-aged men, it's one of the highest causes of death too.
Right.
And it's not something we're talking about. We treat mental health with a stigma, and we treat it separately from the rest of the category of the human existence, but it all ties in with the socioeconomic, with equality, with healthcare. It's all a part of the deal.
So I know as recently as the Vietnam War, you know, the 70s, early 70s, we didn't even really have words for this. We called it shell shock. I may have my facts wrong, maybe by the Vietnam War, we were calling it post-traumatic stress disorder. But that's still quite recent. That's within our lifetime. We've even known what to do with this or how the body responds to trauma. And then, of course, you add on to that, as you've mentioned, especially for men, this socialization that most American men, straight men especially, have been through, is to be tough, to be strong, to not really talk about our feelings, to feel that we should be able to handle whatever it is we're facing on our own. And if we're not able to, then that means there's really something wrong with us. And somehow that wrongness is tied to our masculinity or something like that. And you know, again, I was just talking to Tim about some of these issues, and I was just talking to Brian Peck a couple episodes ago about trauma. And I think it's going to take a while for us to even know, how do we know if we've had this experience of trauma? So I've personally, I know I've experienced trauma or abuse that led to trauma in my experience, but I still don't quite know how that manifests for me.
Well, in my case, the thing that I had to come clean on is I've always spoken to the fact that I was abused when I was a child. But what I've never said is that from the age of 9 to 13, I was with a stepfather where he and his best friend were pedophiles.
Oh, my. Wow.
And this was sustained torture that also came along with physical abuse at a very tender age. And then it happened again when I was 16 at the hands of a youth leader in the church I was attending.
Mm. And is this something you've always had in your memory, or had you blocked it out and it's only recently sort of returned to you?
No, there's been no resurfacing of memories. Okay. It's not things I've forgotten. I was always aware of them. I just never talked about them.
Understandably, right? I mean, it's a horrible experience and not something you would naturally want to talk about.
And you know, again, with what you spoke of with toxic masculinity, it felt emasculating as a man to admit to that.
Right. Yeah. So how did you, I mean, under what circumstances were you able to finally start talking about it?
After I attempted suicide.
So just that recently?
Yeah. That was when I started telling the therapist in the hospital, this happened.
Mm.
And once I started saying this happened, then the flashbacks occurred and it was just nightmare footage I couldn't turn off. And they told me that this surfacing is common. And when you have that and you're in an untreated state and you're finally disclosing, the body reacts as if it is happening now.
Yeah, I've heard that. Wow. So all those years of therapy and you never told anyone?
No, I kept that part to myself, which made it hard for them to treat me
right
properly.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I can relate, and I don't, you know, I know probably others listening can relate. I remember distinctly having the feeling, the thought, you know, I should tell my therapist about X, and thinking, no, that's too scary, too risky, like she'll judge me, you know, which is my big fear in life is, you know, being judged and rejected. And then thinking, well, but I'm paying her this really good price. You know, I'm really wasting my money if I don't tell her the thing that's the, like, perhaps the most important thing for her to know in order to help me. And still it took a long time, you know, to take that risk, as you said earlier about taking risks. I mean, this is a huge risk for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. And it's one of the reasons why I'm writing about it so openly is I believe that there, I wrote a piece in my column about Dolores Oroidian after she passed. She was the lead singer of the Cranberries.
Right.
And she was very open about her bipolar depression. She was open about her suicidal ideations and addiction and so many other things. And she was a personal hero of mine. What she gave me was a Me Too factor. So as I write about this, I'm having other people come to the forefront and approach me and say, me too, and thank you for writing this. Me too, I understand what it feels like to not want to live anymore. I know what that trauma feels like that you're going through. Hey, I'm being treated for PTSD. I'm a couple years ahead of you. Here's what's going to come down the road. You're off to a great start, kid.
Yeah, and it gets better? Is that part of the message you're hearing?
It gets better, but it's always going to be a rough and bumpy road.
Right. Yeah, there's no like pill you can take that just makes it go away.
No, no. And it's going to take a long time with a therapist to feel safe enough to start going back into the trauma points. I have spent an entire lifetime conditioned, my amygdala has basically taken over. Even when there is no danger, I'm always in fight and flight mode.
Yeah, Brian Peck talked about that. That is so, keep going. Yeah, that's amazing.
No, and it has affected so much of my life. My romantic relationships, I've always had one foot out the door. And I have also put myself into positions where I allow things to happen that are hurtful to me. And the other thing is job insecurity. Ever since I left ministry, I have had, other than the taxi, most of my jobs were short-lived because I had one foot out the door and I felt unsafe.
Right.
And I had to work past that. And that's a process. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not done with it, but every day is a practice of presence.
Say more about presence.
Presence. Be here now is a short way to say it. If you spend most of your life ruminating in the past and fearing what lies around the bend, you're never here. And my brain has been wired since childhood to think a certain way. The good news is I'm finding out that you can rewire your brain, but it takes a conscious effort. And so you have to spend every day, am I actually in danger? No. So you have to get those connections between the higher brain functions and the base brain functions to start working. And I'm going to describe it poorly, but there's limited energy that our brain can do in building those synapses. So the more energy that you put into that and consciously build those synapses that are more healthy, the less room there is for the brain to do the unhealthy ones. But it's a long process because you're rewiring a house that has been short-circuiting for decades.
Yeah, and it takes time, right? It doesn't happen necessarily quickly.
Exactly.
And you talked a moment ago about your self-esteem, and then you said more recently you talked about allowing things to happen in your life that were harmful to you, like letting those things happen. I wanted to ask you if you see a connection between those, and if you see a connection between those and the sort of the script that you were given from your faith. And I certainly don't mean to like lead the witness, as we would say. If the answer is no, that's fine. But I'm wondering if there's a faith component to the sense of self-esteem that you describe.
Here's what I will say. I already had this component of low self-esteem and what I call personality tofu. Instead of having my own individual self, I absorb the flavors around me. What church did, there was some good and bad. The good was it gave me a structure that I didn't have. There was a good and a bad. There was a line, and I needed those boundaries because I had nothing. But at the same time, it was built on a story that I am, in fact, evil.
Right.
And that I am a reprobate. And there came some shame with that maybe I brought this upon myself. And that maybe I invited this. And that the only rescue was some God that was going to take all of this away. But whenever the pain didn't go away, well, there's hidden sin in your life, there's this, there's that. So it didn't create it, but it reinforced it. And the other thing that it robbed from me was the ability to take credit for the good things that I did. Because God did it all. I was a vessel.
Right. Yeah, it's like gaslighting on a grand scale.
Yeah.
Like basically blaming yourself for things that were out of your control.
No, I was about to say, and one thing that I am finding is I am less angry at religion than I used to be. I'm not saying I embrace its tenets, but I know some people that are Episcopals, for instance, that there's something healthy that they're getting from it.
Sure.
And my child was in a very diverse high school environment. And as an honor student, there were a lot of friends and peers that were Indian or Muslim. And Dave's Muslim friends are beautiful young adults. And the same goes for some of Dave's friends who were raised in the Hindu and Hindi tradition. It's fascinating once you get past your anger to not hate those that think differently. My beef is against those that exercise what they believe in a harmful manner.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, like any corrupt system, you know, something that maybe was potentially helpful gets used by people in power to create harm and to, you know, like enrich oneself at the expense of others. And it's a powerful story to keep people on the hook. I mean, if you wanted someone to buy, you know, a medication, say, for example, from you, and, you know, to do that, you had to convince them that they would never recover and that the only way that they could be healthy is to take this medicine perpetually for their entire life. You know, that's a guaranteed customer, right? I mean, you're never going to lose that customer. And if you can convince them that you're right about that. So, you know, Christianity in that sense is like, you know, like I used to experience going to the chiropractor. Like you go once and now you have to keep going.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's, you know, it's funny because when I was a minister, I always used to, whenever I was clashing with atheists and they would say the world would be better off without religion, blah, 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 blah. My response always was, you know, religion is the excuse to hate and not the cause of the hate. Mm. And what I'm finding out is on this side of the fence, I am seeing some truth of that because I am seeing in the, in certain pockets of the atheist community, I'm seeing misogyny, I'm seeing sexism, I'm seeing transphobia, and I'm seeing people take things too far, where you have Islamophobia and you have anti-Semitism, which historically has always proven to be a very dangerous thing.
Right. Yeah, and even some of the defenses that I'm reading of highly, like, credibly suspected sexual...
men who have harmed women in the atheist community.
Yeah.
Men who are on the lecture circuit, who are published, who have large followings through their podcast or their radio show or whatever they may have.
Right. Yeah. And then the defenses of those men from other people sound very much like the defenses that you might hear of Catholic priests accused of similar crimes. And it just, it's baffling to me that this isn't more apparent, that it really is, you know, at some level, at least about defending your tribe and circling the wagons around your people. It doesn't matter the thing that's been done. It matters that they're your people who have done it, not their people. And I, you know, you and I lived for decades in a system like that. I'm not interested in that. Like, I left that already once, you know? I didn't leave that to go back into a different system that has the same, you know, problems and the same sort of blindness to its own ability to be corrupted or the lack of humility. I can't understand why someone would jettison a whole system that provided social support and take the risk of doing that to oneself and community and all the rest, to then turn around and embrace another system that's doing it.
Well, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I don't take part in any of the conventions. I don't take part in any of the atheist communities anymore, not even the clergy association. I don't Right. take part in any of these because I've seen this before. And I kind of understand, and I'm not wanting to put myself on the same level of these people, but in some ways I understand people who have survived the Holocaust. Look at the American political system now and say, guys, there's some things we've seen here before that are very dangerous.
Right.
In the same way, having been a minister and knowing some of the dirt that some of my peers were guilty of and participants of, and knowing about the Whisper Network there, as I come over to this side of the fence, I started seeing those patterns repeat. And I'm just like, hey, guys, there's a problem here. And it fell on deaf ears. So it was just like, all right, I'm pulling the ripcord. I am an I am an agnostic atheist by my belief and life philosophy, but my association is not with any of these organizations, save yours and being a columnist in Pathos Non-Religious.
Right. And this is really a tragedy, I think. I mean, people are free to live their lives however they want. And I'm in a similar way. I work for a secular organization, and so I'm involved to that point. But my work is primarily, if not exclusively, around supporting college students and some high school students in their identity formation and value formation as they try to navigate the world as brand new adults without a religion, which has historically and traditionally been the keeper of the value systems in societies. You know, we've sort of outsourced our value development to religious groups. And so, you know, we're in uncharted waters here, where we're in a society now in America that is almost reaching, the youngest generations are almost reaching 50% unaffiliated with any religion. And so the question is, where and how will young people find their ethics and their morals and their values? And of course, they'll get that in the ways they've always done it, from their families and from their education and from reading and from their friends. But that's very, I think historically, going back as far as Aristotle, you know, philosophers and thinkers have agreed that this isn't enough. Like, there needs to be an intentional way that we impart critical thinking skills, values, how we shape our ethics as an individual. And again, a lot of that comes from family. You're teaching your child how to think, and he's helping you. they're helping you learn things as well. So there's a mutuality there. But and also circling back to our conversation about loneliness and depression and untreated mental health issues, I feel that community is going to, in some shape or form, need to be a part of that. Like, and it's a shame that it seems there are so few alternatives for folks that aren't religious in the sense of believing in a divine being. You know, they're atheists or agnostics, as you've said, but lack a place to be human together with other people. Do you feel that at all, or are you kind of thinking that that's overdone?
No, okay. Here's what I'll say to that. A sense of community is important. That's one of the things that I missed most about church, was a tribe. And I tried to find that with atheist groups, and it just wasn't happening, mostly because of the triggers of seeing this harm before, seen what powerful men can do before, I'm out. I find that community with parents of transgender and gender nonconforming. Thank you. And I find beauty in that coalition. And I also find beauty in my protest activities and such as that. That is where I find my community right now. Now, my child is fascinating because Dave is finding their community in PRISM, which is similar to the Secular Student Alliance. It's a group of people at college and high school campuses across the country that are all LGBTQ. Dave currently serves as vice president of his college's chapter. That's where the activity is being found most. And that's where Dave is finding their torch to find their own protest and their own voice. And there's also a huge incentive in getting fellow students to vote. Mm-hmm. And that's happening in droves. I had actually asked Dave about the Secular Student Alliance.
I remember.
And Dave's response wasn't negative to the SSA, but it was just, as a former pastor's kid, Dave's response was, you know what? Religion, non-religion, those things don't really register on my radar as much as the cause of queer equality.
Yeah, it's on the same axis, you know, religion, non-religion is still on that same axis. And I resonate with what Dave is saying, because we do see that, you know, we see students that are, most of our SSA leaders are involved in other types of activism on their campus as well. And which is always inspiring to see. These kids are polymaths, you know, they're doing not only excellent work in their academics, but holding down several club leadership positions and a job. And, you know, it's really, really remarkable. And also very frank and open, to be honest with you, about their own mental health challenges. I mean, it was remarkable. We just announced our 11 scholarship recipients recently, and almost to a one, they spoke about their identity as being non-conforming in some way, and they spoke about mental health challenges that they faced, large and small, you know, if we can even scale them like that. But they were very open about who they are, and I think this is an encouraging sign. If we can say, like, if I could say, oh yeah, I have you know, childhood onset diabetes, you know, like I don't, but if I did, I don't think I would feel a ton of shame in, like, you know, sharing that information. It's nothing that I did. I just inherited it from my family, versus saying, oh yeah, I struggle with, you know, bipolar disorder and depression. That's just who I am, you know, that's just who I am. Or I'm on the spectrum, you know, that's who I am. And that's my reality. And my, that's my context. It's my lens through which I see the world. I just think it's such an encouraging sign to see young adults owning it and just leading from it, you know, leaning into it and just leading from that space that just gives so much more permission for others to be vulnerable and open about who they are, whether they're queer or lonely or whatever it is that we are. We're just humans. We're just like these, you know, meat sacks that are trying to get through the world and enjoy ourselves, you know, and to be flourishing people.
And if I may, I think you touched on something that's very important here. And what that is with the Secular Student Alliance, you have people that are embracing things and they're running towards something as opposed to being defined by what they're not. And that, along with good and responsible leadership, is one of the most important things. And this is going to bring, if I may, sort of touches on what really concerns me most. February of last year, we had an incident where BuzzFeed News broke a story about Lawrence Krauss. And in the aftermath of that, there was a prominent atheist in the community who is well respected and has even gone into more feminist causes, that when he was being questioned by a reporter, an investigative reporter, he criticized it horribly. First by saying, you know, this reporter had no right to call me, and this is a breach of professional ethics. And then said, well, you know, it's just BuzzFeed, thinking of BuzzFeed as a
listicles,
as a entertainment entity, without doing any research to know that between 2014 and 2016, they won National Press Foundation Awards.
Right.
2015 was the Sydney Award. 2017, British Journalism Award, the George Polk Award. And they were finalists in 2017 for Pulitzer Prizes in international reporting.
Right.
I mean, these are, this, there is a serious journalism arm. And the writer in question was Virginia Hughes, who at the time was, she led the BuzzFeed science desk. There was a science division. That's something we should embrace.
Right.
Unfortunately, in this case, she was writing about the darker side of science. Now she's the deputy editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News. This is somebody who is a well-respected, well-educated investigative journalism. And the thing that I want to say about the contacting people, I've taken courses on investigative journalism, and investigative journalism and science actually follow a similar process. With traditional news, you're saying who, what, when, why, and where, and how.
Right.
You're just answering those stories. But as an investigative journalism, journalist, you start off with a hypothesis. That's what you're trained to do. You have a hypothesis. And then you have to work and prove that hypothesis. If it doesn't prove out, you adjust your hypothesis and go in a different direction. It is a very similar process to the scientific process to go from hypothesis to proven theory. And then when you put out your story, unlike a normal news story, you don't just say it, you have to show it. And one of that is pursuing your sources. If you don't keep calling those sources to try to get a response, then you end up with an even more troubling thing. So-and-so could not be reached for comment. Or if you want to be passive aggressive as a reporter, you can say so-and-so had no response, which sounds a little darker. This is a professional favor to you to give you the opportunity to say something so that your silent voice doesn't get noted with suspicion.
Right.
That is professional journalism, because if you go back to your editor and you say, I couldn't get a comment, the editor is going to say, knock on the doors, call.
Try again. Yeah.
Go to where they work. Get a comment. You have to get a comment. That's all Virginia was doing. Virginia was following her training. She was pursuing the hypothesis. She was doing her job and doing it well. And to have her led into being doxxed, to have her led into being marginalized, and even being threatened by people who claim to be part of the atheist community was reprehensible.
Yeah, I mean, I said as much on a Facebook thread and got myself blocked in a hot second.
Right. And I'm using this example because I was one of those people that was blocked. And I'm also a columnist who had a father that worked for the Chicago Tribune as a photojournalist. I love journalism. And when I do my columns, though they're 90% op-ed, I follow journalistic ethics. I follow journalistic integrity, and I follow the process. And most of my information comes from news journalism and investigative journalism. Those are my sources to formulate my opinions and express them. So they're an educated opinion, and they follow a process and a procedure that I hold dear. And, you know, either stay in your lane or study the other lane before you criticize it.
Yeah, and this has been a source of consternation to me as well, because one of the parallel movements to the atheist movement per se is the skeptic movement. And a lot of people don't make a ton of distinctions between these things. But if you talk to someone who claims to be or identifies, self-identifies as a skeptic, they will quickly remind you that they're not the same, that skepticism is about questioning things. It's about using scientific methods to discover knowledge. It's about doubting your conclusions and digging deeper and being curious and finding out the facts. You know, it's about questioning hyped up cultural memes like anti-vaxxing and UFOs and, you know, whatever have you, like whatever the trend is at the moment. Skeptics say, I'm not so sure. You know, you should only eat a meat diet. You know, that's the new thing. Well, I'm not so sure. Okay, so you should only eat mangoes. Like, that's the, well, you know, hang on a second. Let's think about that. So this is skepticism, you know, and I can't tell you how many self-described skeptics I have watched just be so credulous about the most ridiculous things that a moment's Googling would, you know, a freshman in high school could figure out the answer. So, you know, that is deeply frustrating to me. And I don't think it's, I think we should continue being skeptics. I think we should continue, we should do better at it, not worse. And I, you know, unfortunately though, the gatekeepers of skepticism have a lot of influence, and it's a real disappointing thing.
And the biggest problem of that is, as, and I can now say this, as a victim of sexual assault, I know what it feels like to be the victim. Right. Now, I don't understand it from a female's perspective, because a woman endures sexism, microaggressions daily.
Yeah.
Daily. And When we turn it into a bunch of little fanboys that are putting the woman on trial and calling and putting her through judgment, putting her through the ringer, and not respecting her in the name of skepticism, that's being a bully. That is playing word games, and that is diminishing. And you are not showing humanity. You're not showing skepticism. You're just being an asshole.
Yeah.
You are hurting people, and you're being misogynistic, and you're being part of the problem, and you are following the same playbook that the evangelicals are following in the wake of sexual molestation.
Yeah, and it's not even good skepticism, as I was saying, too, because it's, you know, when you look at the context and the history of reports of sexual violence, you know, you realize that only between 2 and 4 or 2 and 6% of cases are fabricated, you know? So it's like well over 90% of the cases are true. And when you have multiple corroborating witnesses or testimonies to the thing, it drops to like 99% of the cases turn out to be real and true. So, you know, it's just not even good skepticism to trot out this thing like, well, what about due process? You know, as if, you know, Lawrence Krauss is on trial in a court of law. We're not talking about a court of law. We're talking about, should he be a guest at a prominent conference, or even not a prominent conference, just a conference where there's going to be, you know, unsuspecting guests there that he might prey on. You know, he doesn't have to be convicted by a trial judge in order to be disqualified from being present at a conference. You know, like that's two different things.
We always have to err on the side of caution, and we always have to err. Well, maybe not always, but this is my feeling on it. We have to err on the side of caution. We have to lean towards the most vulnerable.
Yeah, protecting people.
If we're able to call ourselves a humanist community, if we're able to call ourselves moral. And we now live in a society where in, 2017, a woman was killed on U.S. soil fighting Nazis. What have we become? It is now okay. I mean, it's always been okay to be racist, but it's now becoming even more okay to be racist. It's now becoming more okay to be misogynistic. My child's civil rights were stripped away within a month of Trump being in office by Nancy DeVos.
Yep.
And that's scary. My kid is fighting literally for their lives.
Right.
And coming out with the mental health, you know what? I know some prominent atheists that are very skeptical of that too, and in an unhealthy way, where you're treated differently and you face the stigma even here. And there's something very scientific that's happening to my brain.
Huh.
And don't judge me. Don't slam me, and don't make it hard for me to talk about this, because right now I'm just speaking to the world. I don't care what they believe. If you've suffered trauma, here's my story. Let's talk.
Yeah.
That's all I want to do, because I want us to be able to say it's okay that I'm not okay. And there's a lot of people, Christian, atheist, Muslim, whatever, that are saying it's not okay to be not okay. No, it is okay to be not okay.
Mm. Thank you so much for that. And I think your story is so powerful. It's, it's in the written word, as you've written on your blog and your column. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes so folks can follow you. Please do follow Pat's
Transparent Expedition on Patheos.
Transparent Expedition. And I'll put the link. You can subscribe so that you get a notification when he posts a new post. And, follow him on social media. You have a really unique voice in the sense that, you know, you do have a gender nonconforming child that you've done a beautiful job parenting. And of course, none of us parents are perfect. We always make mistakes, but you've been so open about your desire and your commitment to honoring who they are, and also your own personal struggle and journey to heal from the trauma that was inflicted upon you. And it's a really moving story. And I just want to thank you so much for sharing it.
I appreciate that. The road ahead is one of being honest with myself and others, which I historically have not done very well. And for the first time in my life, trying to believe in myself. And I appreciate the opportunity to come back here again, because I listened to that first interview and I cringe because I recognize somebody who was not okay and wasn't ready to come to grips with it. Mm. And being able to simply be me here today meant a lot. Thank you.
And I also want to just say, if you're listening and you're struggling, there are a lot of resources out there to support you. You don't need to do this alone. Keep listening, and in the closing of the show, I'll share some places that you can find the help that you need. Don't do this alone, and we want you to stick around. So reach out. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you for tuning into this edition of The X-Files. And thank you to Pat Green for courageously telling his story. I think I speak for all of us when I say, we're so glad you're still here, Pat. We love you. If you or someone you know is contemplating suicide, there is help. Please reach out and talk to someone. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Please do not suffer alone. Call today and get help. To learn more about The X-Files and Life After God, please visit our website at lifeaftergod.org. Thank you for spending a portion of your day with me. Until next time, my name is Ryan Bell, and this has been The X-Files, Stories of Life After God.